Welcome to the African American Wisdom Summit, a production of the Shift Network. I'm Nadira Ade, and we are so glad that you are joining us. I'm very excited to introduce our special guest, Bill Blackburn. When Bill was 11 years old, he watched on television as black kids barely older than he were vilified and spat upon in Little Rock. It broke him open to being able to see the harsh realities that exist behind the shining chimera of Ozzie and Harriet America. He has worked to manifest the stated yet only aspirational values of our nation and culture ever since. Bill spent 6 years with the Untraining, Unlearning White Liberal Racism group based in the San Francisco Bay Area, deepening his understanding of systemic and enculturated racism and white privilege. He has participated for over 15 years in having difficult conversations and deep connections at Diversity 2000 retreats. He has worked on issues of peace with justice, global hunger, gay liberation, heart-centered community building, race and class issues, intersectionality, intimacy, circle processes, and communication across difference. Bill, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the call today.
Thank you, Nadira. It's lovely to have this conversation.
So we can just get started and dive right in. I would like to know if you can just talk to us a little bit about your early awarenesses of race.
Well, I grew up in a fairly white town in western Pennsylvania, but I remember viscerally standing in my living room watching as these kids trying to go to high school, they were just, I don't know, 5 years older than me or something, being attacked by the, I guess it was the state or something like that, with dogs and hoses, and just vilified. And it was just horrifying to me. It had never come to my mind that somebody might be treated like this in the United States. And my dad, who was a good Eisenhower Republican, and I want to say Republicans then were very different than they are now, he was outraged at what was happening. You know, he had taught me to love my country and believe in my country and all our stated values, and he was outraged and really supportive of Eisenhower when he finally sent in national troops to escort the kids to school days or a week later or whatever it was. But it had it was a defining moment in my life, in that the things that I had been taught to believe in were not necessarily true, and it led to a lifetime of questioning. And I'm a gay guy. I didn't come out until my early 20s, but I always knew I didn't belong. I wasn't like I was supposed to be in some ways, and I think that gave me a lot of affinity to others who were disadvantaged or disapproved of, and so that's another piece of that early time in my life when I started to wake up to the realities of what our country was really like and the reality of racism.
I know that you shared your essay, SIP, with me, and I would really appreciate it if you could just take a moment and share it with us on the call right now.
Well, as you mentioned already, I was part of the Untraining, which is subtitled Unlearning White Liberal Racism. You know, there's a lot of good people that have great intents to not be racist, but yet we've all been enculturated in this. Out of that Untraining experience, we formed a writing group. And so I basically, this was written as a fast write, like a 20, 25-minute time to write, and I've barely changed it since then. So the intensity of it shows how long I've carried this incident, which I'm going to talk about here in the essay. So, tip for Nate. He surely knew it was a test, though I had no thought of its significance. He must have known how much he'd learned from the simple gesture and my response, though it was something that could have slipped by me unnoticed. And absolutely, he knew that the others would see and judge me by my actions. Hot and humid day, hard at work, Nate stretched out his muscled arm toward me, a Coke, its green glass exterior dewed and dripping with condensation, pro-offered. Did he say it or only imply, sip? My yes, implied or stated, yes. I took the sip unthinking, grateful for the quick burst of coldness as it washed into my mouth. Did I make eye contact with him at the moment? Surely I did, just as surely I would not make eye contact with the others for long after. I'd never known race till I took a summer job twixt high school and college, building walk-in coolers in East Liberty, Pennsylvania. But I quickly saw that Nate was treated differently than the rest of us, even different than newbie me. I'd been clueless of privilege. I'd lived in a world of whiteness till then, whites to the right, to the left of me, whites before and behind me as I strode into that job that hot summer of 1964. Clueless of class, but surely clueless of race and how it matters. Nate, funny, kind, patient in teaching me the nature of constructing those walk-in coolers. But a bigger teaching he gave me, the nature of race in America. The boss tried me out mixing the chemicals that hardened into insulating foam for the walk-in freezers. Yet when I got sick from the fumes, like everybody did, the boss gave the job back to Nate, though he had more seniority than most of the other men. He's not sensitive to the fumes, I was told, but surely I did not believe that lie. No, he was sickened by the fumes and surely sickened by the racism that caused him to be assigned that ugly job, just as I came to be sickened by my inability to articulate a protest. And then, that hot and humid day, the tin roof radiating heat down on us, shirts sticking to skin, the smells of sawdust and steel and working men, and the simple gesture of his Coke extended toward me, stated or implied, sip? I took that sip and all the rest of the men I'd come to befriend ceased talking to me except when the work demanded. And I knew. I was white, yet not quite white enough. I was white, but not white enough.
Can you speak a little bit and tell us what that means, not white enough?
Yeah, there is a pressure to own privilege. It's in some ways thrust on us, like I felt like that, taking that job away from an entry-level person, me, and giving it to someone much more senior than me because he was black. That privilege was sort of thrust on me. And then when I met the disapprobation of my white coworkers, I felt this pressure that I'd done something wrong, and I could have gone either way. I mean, I slipped into awareness and probably guilt at the time, but others could just wrap themselves up in that privilege and move on and not pay much attention to the incident at all. There's a pressure not to associate across lines that I think that's true with race, but that's probably true, well, certainly true across class and all sorts of other places as well. So that's, I guess, what I'm talking about when I say I wasn't white enough to receive the approval of my coworkers there. You know, there's an analysis that race is constructed that it helps divide poor people so that poor whites feel better than poor blacks, and disadvantaged people feel higher up the scratching line than those below. If we can find a way to bring that kind of awareness into the world and realize that, I guess there's a at the diversity conference one time said, we don't want you to give up your privilege. This was to the white people in general. We don't want you to give up your privilege. We want you to work to privilege everyone. And I think that's ultimately the work that we have ahead of us.
Can you speak to some of the ways that you see white guilt and shame as an impediment to helping white people get racism, including its manifestations and effects?
Yes. So guilt and shame, when I first started to get involved with the untraining, a good friend of mine who is white and has a great progressive views on the world and so on, when I told him I was working on racism, he said, oh, racism, he said, isn't that just a way to make white men feel guilty? And it shocked me. It was like, what an attitude from somebody so dear and open to the world and working for good. But I think that issue of guilt and shame really causes people to shut down. So what I try to do is I try to pay attention to the behavior, focus on the behavior and not the identity. It's almost impossible to change identity. So if we say someone is racist and we give them that label, either that forces that behavior in them and that identity, or they resist it and walk away. Where if I say what I saw was insensitive and I'd like to share with you what could have been better done in or said in that instance, people are much more open to it than if I would say you're a racist or what you did was racist. So I think that I'm thinking of the article by essay by Robin DiAngelo, White Fragility. It's a great to look up on the internet. White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. She talks about how we are so walled away from these confrontations that even and of color work to protect us from these harsh realities, and so it takes some strengthening for white people to really feel strong enough to have these conversations. And I think that's really what we need to do is have people step up and have the conversations, even if they're uncomfortable. Especially if they're uncomfortable, then you're going to learn something if it's uncomfortable. So I think that it's really important for white people to be willing to have these conversations. Early on, I had it described to me that to be an ally to people of color, you have to be willing to make mistakes. You have to be willing to engage and to make mistakes, and if you do make a mistake, be willing to be educated about it and apologize. And that, to me, is an important thing that people need to step into.
I know that you have the perspective or the vision that Black Lives Matter, as well as Occupy, We Are the 99%, the environmental and immigration reform movements, and even the Tea Party are basically stating the same thing, and ultimately they need each other. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes, I feel, you know, at first I heard it most clearly from the Tea Party, but then I think they got co-opted by propaganda manipulators, Fox News and the Koch brothers and others. But originally they were saying the system isn't working for we the people. And shortly after that, Occupy Wall Street emerged, and they were saying the same thing. The system is not working for we the people. And that's certainly what I hear in Black Lives Matter, the environmental movement, immigration reform movements, and many others, is the system isn't working for us. And so I see how the right unifies across all sorts of very, very different issues. If you're pro-gun or anti-choice, pro-corporatism or pro-NSA spying, anti-gays, racists, they all unite somehow to have electoral power. And yet the progressive world tends to break off in silos. I'm an environmentalist, or I'm an anti-racist, or I'm pro-gay rights, or so on, and I income inequities and so on, where these issues all align much better than the right cobbles together issues. We're talking about progress, we're talking about human dignity, we're talking about rights. And so I'd love to see us have conversations about how we can come together and support each other's, I was going to say support each other's issues, but no, take on each other's issues, absorb each other's issues into our own movements, not to dilute any of the individual ones, but to form coalitions across these issues and gain more electoral power and cultural power.
Do you have any suggestions or ideas about ways that our listeners can start to take action or make change in their own lives and in the world around them?
Well, yes. I've been working on this stuff for a long time, but just this last weekend I took a small training offered here in the North Bay of on implicit bias, and even having done this work for a long time, I was still caught up, surprised by some of the things that were brought forth in that training. So if people can find trainings around implicit bias or unconscious bias is another term for it, that's a great place to start to work on these issues or to continue to work on these issues. And also, as I said earlier, be willing to have difficult conversations and stay in the heart while doing that, to not get defensive, to not shut down. If you say something that is offensive to somebody or do something that's offensive to somebody, be willing to have a conversation about it. Be willing to learn and engage and stay in the heart, stay in compassion, both for the other person but also for yourself. We were enculturated in this work. Yeah, I mean, in these attitudes of racism and homophobia and all the other things, we were enculturated in it. We didn't ask for these things as children, but they were put into us through exposure, what we saw and didn't see on television and in the news and in history. So many different things were disappeared in our history and in our schools' training. So be willing to have these difficult conversations. Forgive yourself and apologize if you've offended somebody, and move through it and learn.
Do you have a final thought that you'd like to leave us with? Bill, is there anything else that you would like to share before we sign off?
Well, I have this piece that I wrote last year that I would like to bring in. It speaks to issues broader than race and whiteness, but it speaks to that integrated place where I'm hoping that the movements of progressive movements can join together. So it's my best shot so far at trying to bring it all together in one place. So it's called Crazy, I Know. My head exploded again last night. I hate it when that happens. I was watching an episode of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver when it happened, but it could easily have been when reading a bit of news online or contemplating another aspect of our crazy, crazy world we live in. It's not the world's fault. It's what we've done with it that makes my head explode. fracking water being used to water food crops makes my head explode. Far from the best and brightest of the land who are running for the presidency in 2016, most of them denying science and all personal integrity, make my head explode. 22 veterans on average committing suicide in the U.S. every day makes my head pop. The thought that capital can constantly expand in a limited and ever-diminishing planet makes for brain splats all over my walls. Politicians making a moral case for taking food from hungry babies and health care from sick people and long-promised security from vulnerable seniors, kaboom, a bloody neck stub rises rude above my collar. Preachers preaching hate, imams with murderous edicts, rabbis koshering genocide, Buddhist monks attacking Hindus, attacking Sikhs, it's boom time inside my skull all over again. Queer kids tossed from good Christian homes into a life on the streets. Heroes exiled for exposing lawbreakers instead of lawbreakers prosecuted. Politicians openly displaying as high-priced prostitutes, and we got skull fragments everywhere. The scarcity model clung to, seven generations sacrificed for the quarterly bottom line, shitting in our own nest. Boom. I've managed to survive heartbreak. I say my heart breaks every day and grows back bigger and stronger every time. That's just heartbreak, the price of staying awake. I've managed to survive heartbreak. I've even managed to survive craziness. It's said that you have to be crazy to be sane in this crazy world, and I know that to be true. I found that I cannot stop trying to hold the bigger picture and shining light into shadow, and that alone is crazy, so I know crazy. I know the script. Focus in, take care of number one, contract down and get grabbing. Crazy me, I refuse, but somehow escape the men in white coats. Of course, there are no white coats anymore. Reagan closed the asylum in order to create the homeless. There is no asylum big enough to hold us anyway, no matter the need. But the horror of the modern day and our supposedly advanced civilization, my head explodes and I die a bit each time. Our bombs in the Middle East blowing up mothers in front of their children and children in front of their mothers, boom. Our food animals tortured, boom. Young black and brown men with no hope and no chance, summarily murdered by men in uniform who are filled at best with fear and most likely a deep racism that is unconscious and inherent in our culture, boom. More and more poison sprayed on crops as pollination necessary bees and butterflies drop all round. Boom, boom, boom. I can survive heartache and craziness, but when my head explodes, part of me dies. My hope dies. My faith in humanity dies. Unless we're willing to wake up and put away our fears, our debates, and our otherings, my hope will die along with the oceans. Yet I hold on to hope. This crisis itself gives me hope in the creative tension it generates. Crazy, I know.
That's beautiful. Thank you. And thank you for taking the time to speak with us and for everyone listening to this session with Bill Blackburn today. Please be sure to join us for the next session.